Hi there, I'm Dr. Dearan O'Leary and I'm a GP in Cork City. The aim of my podcast is to share health information in an easy and understandable way. I ask the experts the questions and they share the facts. I hope you enjoy listening to these conversations as much as I do recording them. Today, I'm really excited about our guest, who is Dr. Dimitri Wall. He's a consultant dermatologist at Hair Restoration BlackRock. And Dr. Wall has a specialist interest in conditions that affect the hair and scalp. So, okay, can we start off with what are the most common causes of hair loss and hair thinning?
It's very difficult to know exactly because a lot of the information we have about hair is very much word of mouth. When studies try to look at these things, they give variable results. I mean, the two main types that you're taught about are typically androgenetic alopecia, which is a combination of genetics and hormones. That's different between men and women. It's a very clear-cut case in the case of men where a lot of this is due to testosterone and its breakdown product, dihydrotestosterone. And what you tend to see is that over the years, in a very particular pattern, we're all aware of what it is. You know, when you see that hair being lost at the front, moving backwards, going to the crown, so there's that. It's hormones plus genetics. In women, it's slightly less clear. In women, we think that androgens, which are male hormones, or that's the best way of describing them, play a significant role. And in a similar way, what you have happen is that hormones affect hair. So what happens is that a hair will start growing. It'll grow for a period of 2 to 6 years. And at the end of that time, it tends to die. And what everyone hopes happens is that a new hair comes in and it takes about 3 months to do that. And what we think happens is that if you're genetically sensitive to hormones, over the years, the new hairs that grow back in, they grow back in, but they're a little bit thinner. They don't grow for as long. And what you have over generations is replacing large numbers of hairs that are quite thick with smaller, thinner hairs. And the result of that, when you look at a woman, is typically when you're looking in the mirror, and you look at the front of your hairline and you start to see more and more scalp visibility, particularly down the middle. So that's probably the main one that people come to me about. And then the other one that people experience in to different degrees is telogen effluvium. Telogen effluvium is this concept that when you go back to that cycle I was talking about of growth and then falling out, that there are certain things that can happen that can cause your hair to stop growing prematurely. It goes into this rest phase that causes telogen. And then people will start seeing more shedding than they're used to. And that can happen for a short period of time, what it's called acute telogen effluvium. And the classic cases that people may be familiar with are if they were very, very sick, if they had lost a lot of blood, if they're in hospital with pneumonia, and then because there's about a 3 month lag phase, it's about 3 months after that that they start seeing a large fall of hair. And then when you look at sort of more chronic telogen effluvium, there's actually the jury is out as to whether that really represents more androgenetic alopecia, that male or female pattern hair loss, or telogen effluvium. And certainly when I hear people ask questions, the entry point that most people come to me at is a lot of people look and they think, my hair is getting thinner. I'm seeing more hair shedding. I wonder, is this a nutritional thing? And people spend an awful lot of time looking for that magic bullet that's going to stop their hair from shedding, stop the progression of their hair loss. So if you look at those two areas, that's usually where the conversation starts with me. You know, there are many other types of hair loss. We might touch on a few of them later if you like, but the main two would be that genetically determined hair thinning, androgenetic alopecia, versus whether or not this is telogen effluvium, this increase in shedding.
And use for the androgenic alopecia, you said that it's a thinning down the middle. Is there a typical pattern for the telogen effluvium, or is that all around the scalp, or is there a pattern for that to recognize it?
So classically, you describe a more generalized diffuse loss because rather than having a pattern, all of the hairs or a large number across the scalp are sent into this premature telogen phase. But if you're to look at a scalp, what they'll classically say is that if you look at the temples, that you'll start to see increase in visibility of the scalp around the temples, which it's not always the most helpful guide, because you know, at least about 10% of women who get female pattern hair loss will actually present with that temple thinning. So, you know, when people come to me, they're often really keen to know what blood investigation should they get done? Are there any other tests? Do they need a biopsy? What does it look like under the microscope? And actually, one of the best determinants over time is to sit down with someone and just spend a good period of time listening to the history, listening to how did it present, how have things changed over the years, to discuss more about the shedding that they're seeing. And I use a kind of a validated scale that was developed by the guy I learned from, Rod Sinclair in Melbourne, that looks at how to judge how much shedding that a woman has. And as you piece together the history, it's, as you see yourself, a lot of the times you almost know what you're going to find when you examine a scalp if you've really listened to someone. And I think that's probably the best bit of advice that I can give anyone who's concerned about hair loss, is that the first thing to do, Google can be really difficult with hair. You end up looking at lots of different nutritional supplements, whether it be biotin, vitamin D, iron, all the different supplements that are out there, rather than asking the first question, which is, well, what is this? Is this an increase in shedding? Is that something that's likely to disappear with time and I don't need treatment? Or is that an early sign of female or male pattern hair loss that I really need to think, do I need to consider treatment for?
Okay, so that's really good advice for me as a GP and for anyone listening, that we don't, well, you know, we obviously, we can facilitate as GPs to do blood tests as necessary and referrals as necessary, but it's in the history. So we need to sit back and actually look at what's happened and how it's happened over time.
And that's difficult, because particularly nowadays, there's a pressure there in terms of time to give people. One of the things you realize with hair is that when you try and rush it, it ends up getting very frustrating. And you do meet a lot of patients who have gone to talk to people, and that, you know, the one thing that's needed is what a lot of people really struggle to get, which is time.
Yeah, that's so true. And it was in my experience, in the few patients who have come to me about it, you know, because we're stuck for time. We know we do a panel of blood tests and refer to dermatology. It's, as you say, just really important to go through the history and look at what's happened. Telogen effluvium is really interesting. So is it any psychological or any stress, like psychological and physical stress, that can cause it?
So it's an area of constant debate. I suppose if you were to ask people whether emotional stress can result in telogen effluvium, we'd say that there are certainly, there's research there that shows that in animals, you can see that. In people, it's a little bit different. I think if you were to ask somebody, when are they certain that it's telogen effluvium, you're talking about a different type of stress. You're really talking more about physical stress. If a woman comes in and says, I've seen hair shedding, you'll typically ask, well, what happened in the last 3 to 6 months? Because you're looking to see, was there a specific event? So if they say, I was admitted to hospital for 2 weeks with pneumonia, I had really high fevers, you're pretty certain that that's probably the cause of the telogen effluvium. If they say, you know, it's been a difficult year, I've been finding that it's a bit more stressful for me, work's been difficult, you start to ask yourself, you know, that I need to find something a little bit more definitive. So the classical things are going to be that you're more sure of if they have had very disturbed thyroid function. That's where some of the blood testing can come in helpful. If they have given birth recently, if they have had major surgery, blood loss, if they have had major weight loss. It's almost like a, you know, and this is probably not the most scientific way of describing it, it's as if there's something that has consumed a lot of your body's energy that is diverted away from hair to other essential things it needed to look after. So it's not the most scientific way of looking at it, but I think for me it's a nice way of kind of determining how confident you are that the shedding you're seeing is a result of the problem that you think has caused it. And I'm usually less convinced that emotional upset has resulted, or even just the chronic stress that has now become part of life has contributed significantly to the telogen and effluvium that I'd see.
Okay, and you mentioned thyroid disease. Is that a common cause of hair loss?
You know, we probably need more evidence to really give us the proper answer, but I look at them as perhaps they're a tiny little piece in a bigger jigsaw. So you wonder whether thyroid is really contributing in a small way, but that there's other things going on. When you see women with female pattern hair loss, there is a small amount of evidence that suggests that you're more likely to see female pattern hair loss in people with metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. So you've now switched from becoming I wonder, can this fix my hair problem, to, well, look, maybe the hair is a sign of something that can be changed with dietary and lifestyle modification. When you look to thyroid testing, you're sort of thinking, you know, I wonder, is there a component of that there that it's more raising the flag that maybe my thyroid needs to be looked after rather than my hair loss? And as you then go into hormonal profiling, I tend to do that because it's a very, very rare case, but maybe 3-4 times a year, I'll have a woman who comes along with hair loss where they have got an unusual production of hormones. So it's a very small cohort, but it's the kind of thing that you'll want to have investigated more thoroughly with imaging, possibly with an endocrinologist involved. Kind of moving towards the nutritional side of hair loss, where a lot of people find themselves because there's over-the-counter medications. You know, you can look at products like biotin, and there's other products out there. One of the interesting things is biotin. Biotin has been described as a real wonder treatment for both hair and nails. And while there's a little bit of evidence that it can help in terms of nail splitting at high doses, there's an FDA warning about biotin because it can impact on laboratory investigations. So it can alter thyroid tests, hormonal testing, because of it's involved in the basis in which a number of these tests are done. But actually, a little bit more concerning, and they've asked manufacturers to address this, is that when you take large doses of biotin, it can affect troponin. So
yes,
we've seen,
and troponin is the blood test that we use to check for a heart attack. So it's really important that that's, you know, exactly right. So yeah, and interfering with the troponin assay is very serious.
Yeah, and if you go online, you'll see even very reputable nutritional products will claim that they provide 80% of a recommended daily allowance of biotin, whereas actually the figures that they're quoting are multiple times the recommended daily allowance. Our gut actually produces biotin usually at the levels that are required. The only time when biotin we think has shown evidence of improving hair is when you've got unusual problems in terms of generating it. So it's when it's inherent inbuilt problems in terms of generating biotin. And the doses that are often out there, so 30 micrograms is the recommended daily allowance of biotin, whereas the treatments out there are typically in the order of about 200 up to about 10,000 micrograms, which are massive multiples of what's actually required. So a lot of the time, a lot of the supplements are looked at as being organic, and because they're organic, that they're not going to do harm. You know, a lot of the time people will take them and they won't have harm, but I suppose it's not really addressing what you think it's going to address. At least that's the experience I think most people have when you look into it in a little bit more detail.
That's really interesting. I mean, because so many of the things that we can buy over the counter that we think are organic or natural could actually be, I mean, look, they might not be harmful, but it sounds like it's not necessary to take biotin, really, you know, that you need to be speaking with your GP or dermatologist if you're worried about hair loss, and it could potentially interfere with lab assays, which is serious. And I mean, look, I actually took biotin myself last year because I had a few surgeries last year, so my hair went thinner, and then I was looking to see what to take, and I took biotin. But then I did read about the interfering with the assays, and I also, I don't know if it was actually the cause of it, but I was developing acne, so I stopped it, so I don't take it anymore. It's interesting that you're saying that
it probably really isn't doing any, it's not useful to take it, and we don't need to take it in those doses.
I haven't been convinced of the benefit. I think, you know, it's something that I think from another perspective, by the time that you've finished buying all the different supplements, you find that the real damage that's done is to your pocket.
As with so many really things, these things just settle with these things. Will put my hair would have probably just recovered with time anyway, and then we think that a supplement has made a difference. Is there anything over the counter or any supplements or anything in our diet? That was when I said to my followers that I'm speaking with you today, one of the most common questions was, what can we do in terms of diet or lifestyle or supplements? Is there anything that we should be doing or that we can be doing?
So I think I always end up going back to the first point, which is, do you need to do something? So to answer that question, you kind of need to know exactly what the underlying problem is. There's some women who come in, and I think one of the most frustrating things for women in particular is when they go into a doctor and they say, my hair is getting thinner. And the doctor looks at them and says, but your hair looks fantastic. It's fine. Yeah. There's nothing wrong. I think the first thing you need to realize in hair is that women are exceptionally good. Men are too, but women are particularly good at identifying when there is a problem with their hair. And the thing is that you have about 110,000 hairs in your scalp at your peak when you're a teenager. And the amount that you need to lose before it's obvious to other people is about half of that. It's about 50,000 hairs. So there's classically this road that people go down when they develop female pattern hair loss, which is that they'll spend a couple of years saying, I'm not sure, but I think, and they'll guess feedback from their friends and their family saying, no, your hair looks fine. And it's not that they're trying to mislead them. It's just they physically can't actually appreciate the change. And a lot of the time I'll see people either in that period where they're exceptionally frustrated or just after that when it's clear what's going on. So I suppose the first thing, which is the difficult thing, is to actually get a sense of what is going on. And can we put a few figures around just how much hair is being lost, the speed at which it's being lost, how much shedding is there? Because there are people who come in and say, I'm really shedding an awful lot. And when you compare it with a validated scale, it's what's really nice is to be able to show them actually the degree to which people shed is there's quite a variation. And actually, you're within the normal realm. And if you continue to shed like this, your head is actually replacing it at a level that you're not going to see a degree of obvious thinning over time. And the other component that you have to quickly realize is you need really good photography, because people need to see with their own eyes. A lot of the time you're very emotionally connected to what your hair is. I mean, hair forms part of a lot of people's character. And when you look in a mirror and you see somebody who looks a little bit different looking back at you because your hair has changed, it's a deeply upsetting thing. So being able to actually show people objective evidence of where their hair is and over time show them how things have evolved, I think is a very important component. So before people jump in and start taking supplements in the hope that they're going to kind of raise the tide, I think it's good to get a sense of where you are, what's going on, what are you going to expect, what is achievable, how are you going to do it? There's so many questions out there, but it all starts off with what's going on.
Yes. Okay. That's really solid advice. I think, you know, so many of us feel, or, you know, women in particular feel like we should be doing something. We have to be doing something. We have to be taking for something for our hair, skin and nails, even if there's not necessarily anything wrong. We can get kind of, because these things are marketed so heavily, you know, that we all get sucked in. So yeah, it's refreshing to hear that we don't need to be going out and buying biotin and things like that at all.
And I suppose it is reassuring that there are a number of treatments out there that are quite effective. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, particularly if you're treating female pattern hair loss, there has been a good bit of movement over the last few years in terms of treatments that you can give women, that your aim, I suppose, in the first instance is, okay, let's see if we can hold on to what's there. But quite a large number of women will come back, and objectively, if you show them a before and after photograph, they can point out which is after, because there's a there's a clear difference between the two in terms of benefit.
So what are the treatments available? I guess it will depend on what the underlying cause is, but for female pattern hair loss, what are the treatments available?
So I suppose there's a huge spectrum ranging from, you know, the nutritional stuff that we talked about, where there's very mm-hmm. little evidence for its benefits, mm-hmm. through to medication. There is surgery, and there's other kind of surgical type techniques, as well as transplantation. And then you move on to some of the emerging therapies. And it's funny, people, for whatever reason, usually either go to nutritional or emerging therapies. And the gold standard is right in the middle. So when you look at medication, what you're typically trying to do is you're trying to block the effect of hormones that cause hair thinning over time. So they're usually medications that are typically very well tolerated amongst women, where you look at either anti-androgens or medications with that anti-androgen component. So they have a capacity to reduce the effect of those, for want of a better term, male type hormones on a woman's hair who's genetically more sensitive to their presence. So when you get your blood test done and you're looking for the hormone levels that are there, almost always they come back as normal. But what happens is that genetically, and we've seen over about 190 genes that you inherit from your parents, they give an increasing degree of sensitivity to those hormones, or at least that's what we think is happening, but there's still a lot to be discovered. And what you'll typically talk to a woman about is looking at a very low dose of a medication that can just reduce the effect that those hormones have on aging your hair from generation to generation. And then that's typically prescribed alongside minoxidil that everybody knows as Regain.
Yeah.
And you can take that either in topical or in an oral formulation. And I suppose the big difference that's happened over the last number of years, it's one of the guy who I again went to learn about hair has done a lot of research on, and it's been changing a lot the way people look about it, is looking at giving very low doses of oral minoxidil. And typically when you combine one of these medications that reduces the hormonal thinning and you bring in minoxidil, what you'll find is that there's one aspect that helps halt progression of hair thinning, and there's another part that looks at stimulating hair to grow a bit thicker again. Instead of growing shorter and thinner, it starts to grow thicker and for longer. And that's what usually translates over time, and it does take time with hair, into longer, thicker hair.
And about how long does it take? It must require an awful lot of patience from the patient's perspective. About how long would a patient be on the treatment, and when would they maybe start to see results of it?
So a lot of this, if you look at what's causing it, it's genetic. So it's essentially your body is programmed to over time be sensitive to these changes that cause your hair to thin out. So it's not something that you're going to switch off. It's always going to be there, and it's really about reducing that impact. So people can take medication for as long as they like, but when they stop treatment, you'll often see the same factors kick back in and that process kicks off again. So you're looking for a lot of women, they will still care as much tomorrow as they will in 10, 20 years. So I suppose one of the main focuses with treatment is knowing that you can take something that you're going to be able to tolerate in the vast majority of people, that it's at a relatively low dose that results in really well-tolerated side effects, if any. And in terms of a timeline, you're probably looking at least 6 months before you see an improvement. And again, that's before you start to see a change in thickness. When you're looking to see an increase in volume of hair, that's going to take longer again, depending on how long you wear your hair.
There are treatments out there available, and people should, you know, come to their GP in the first instance, and then we can refer on to dermatology as necessary. The most common question that I was asked today, without a doubt, was about postpartum hair loss.
Yeah.
What causes it? Does it happen in every woman? Is there anything that pregnant women can do? And does it go away? Can you explain it to us and tell us what to do?
It's a really interesting one, because classically what people have felt is going on is that when you become pregnant, you get a hormonal surge, and particularly they look at estrogen, but there's other hormones that are involved as well, and they increase significantly when you become pregnant. And we think that those hormones cause your hair to stay in a growth phase. And what happens then when you give birth is that those hormones really drop quite suddenly. And all that stimulation for the hair to keep on growing is just gone. And then what happens usually about sort of 3 months later, that going back to that same time period of they're taking about 3 months before something caused your hair to die, to it actually falling out. The drop off in hormones stops promoting the hair growth, and then 3 months later you start to see a degree of shedding. Mm-hmm. When you go and look at studies, there's very scanty evidence about whether that's the case and how frequently this happens. You know, there's a study back in 2015 that actually questions whether or not this is a real thing. Now, once you actually start seeing lots of hair patients, you absolutely know that it happens. Other studies would have suggested about 3% of patients, but I think the incidence is probably much higher than that. And then there's the question that comes in about breastfeeding and whether you're not breastfeeding. And again, there's contradictory evidence about that. I suppose another way to look at it is that what you're essentially getting in pregnancy is that your hair gets thicker, gets a bit more luscious, and that the thing that's driving that, it tends to go. So what can happen over a period of time is you fall back to the level that you're at. And what a lot of people will feel is their real emotional upset of seeing that happen. It doesn't matter whether or not somebody says to them, it's okay, it's going to go back to the same level, until you see the shedding stop and you look at the photos or you look at yourself again and you feel that you're back to normal, you're not going to be happy. It will typically, you know, it can go for 3 to 6 months before you really see it start to turn around. And that's how it's a really difficult time. There certainly are treatments that you can give, depending on when you bring them in, that can help that. But a lot of the time, part of the controversy is that sometimes we see telogen effluvium that happens after you give birth as being a manifestation of an underlying tendency towards female pattern hair loss.
Yes.
And particularly if you've got more advanced female pattern hair loss, because your hair grows for shorter and shorter periods, it can be more pronounced because there's more of the hair in a growth phase when it's getting stimulated. And then when that stimulation drops off, that disappears. So I suppose it again comes back to it is often good to talk to somebody during that time, with the answer being, look, regardless if this is something that is going to persist or get better, or if there's an underlying problem, that there's somebody who can take a look and say, look, I can tell you that there is or there isn't something else going on, and that we can look at various different therapies and about what's the best and safest time to bring those in. So that even if you do have to go through that really tough emotional component, having just given birth of your hair shedding, is that you at least know that you're going to put yourself in a position to get the best possible outcome.
Yes. Okay. So if a woman, you know, is suffering from postpartum hair loss, so in the first instance, you can go to your GP. We can, you know, maybe do a set of blood tests. Would you advise in the first instance just to observe for 3 to 6 months? Or is it hard to say? Is it very much case by case?
I think, yeah, it's really a case of judging just how much this is upsetting somebody and how much time that they're able to give before they feel the need to treat it. And being in a position that you, I suppose if you do feel the need to refer on, that you've got all the work done in advance of that, that will allow a relatively quick referral if needs be.
And then are the treatments the same, Dimitri, then? I mean, for a treatment for a woman with who's got postpartum hair loss, is it the same then as we treat female pattern hair loss? Are they different options?
No, there are different options. And there are certainly parts that can be overlapping, but because a lot of it is about perspective. But again, it's a case of, you know, there are some girls as young as 14 who've come into me with obvious female pattern hair loss. So partially it's a case of sometimes when a woman comes in with postpartum hair loss, they've seen everything become a little bit more apparent. And when they look backwards, they've actually seen that there's a pre-existing problem. So I think it's a very difficult question to, it's a very difficult question to answer, because again, it's going back to, is it the soul thing going on? And if that's the case, the treatments are going to be a little bit different. If there's an underlying female pattern hair loss, there's going to be more of an overlap with female pattern hair loss treatments. But the main thing is just to really establish, if you can say that all the hair shedding that they're seeing, all the thinning that they're seeing, is completely due to postpartum telogen effluvium, or whether there's other patterns that you can see that suggest that there's more to it than that.
Thank you so much for addressing that, because that is one of the most common questions I am asked. Another very popular question that I was asked today, actually, and I wasn't anticipating, but was scalp psoriasis. That really upsets me as well. And I know just from a GP perspective, I see it quite a lot. I prescribe a combination of, I suppose, various shampoos and see how people get on with them. What do you recommend for scalp psoriasis? Is there anything that people should be doing, products they should be using? What's best in your opinion?
Well, I suppose if somebody hasn't been in the position where they have seen a doctor, you're looking at over-the-counter treatments in the first place, and there's treatments like Nizoral shampoo for kind of very mild psoriasis, some of the kind of tar-based shampoos. But a lot of the time, scalp psoriasis is something that's very difficult, because it can be in a very obvious position, and it can really make people feel very upset. And it's, I suppose, to make sure that just because you're looking at the scalp, that somebody isn't, make sure that somebody is taking a holistic look at this, because often what you can have is that you can have scalp psoriasis is the thing that upsets you the most, but actually when you examine someone from head to toe, you realize that their psoriasis is far more extensive.
Yes.
And that starts to make you think about a variety of other treatments. And sometimes the treatments run in parallel. When you look at somebody, if they're not responding to simple topical treatments, you'll then move on to topical steroids. So it's one of the things that you see very frequently in dermatology, is a lot of the time people are given a message of fear about topical steroids. And what they'll do is they'll use a topical steroid very, very sparingly, and they'll get a very, very small benefit. And then what you end up doing is you end up going on this sort of very long chronic treatment. And where we start to see the thinning that people are all concerned about is when you see chronic application of steroids over a long period of time. So actually, again, it's back to the kind of the diagnosis and putting it in the context of how significant the psoriasis is in general in that person, and making sure that you're not just not treating in isolation. A lot of people will respond to topical steroids, or if they have to, you can introduce tar-based treatments, which are smelly, they're sticky, they take time, but they can work very well. And then you move up to treatments that are systemic treatments. So you can take them by mouth, you can take them by injection. And a lot of the time what they're looking at doing is calming down your immune system, which is behaving a little bit inappropriately in the context of psoriasis. The treatments used to be, a lot more difficult to manage than they are now, and an awful lot less effective. And what we've seen over the last 10, 12 years is the emergence of newer medications that are exceptionally well tolerated, easy to use, and they result in very significant clearance. And I suppose one of the things that we look at when you discuss whether to go to those treatments with patients is the area of the body that they affect. And because the face and the scalp is so visible, often you will progress treatments a little bit more quickly when it's that visible. So again, it's always worth going and seeing your GP, because sometimes rather than spending a year of really significant upset, what you needed in the first place is a rapid referral to a dermatologist who can assess that it's safe to proceed with these treatments and get you on a more appropriate treatment really quickly before you go through all the difficulty of trying things that aren't going to be useful in the first instance.
That's it. And people, it's so upsetting for people, distressing for them. And using those scalp products is just so difficult on people. You know, they're so cumbersome. And as you said, the tar products can be very greasy. So, to just, I suppose, if you are seeing it, like, to know that you can see a dermatologist and decisive action can be taken, as opposed to, you know, struggling with it for years. You know, people struggle with it, for so long. And there is a real hesitancy as well about steroids. And I was saying about that, we were talking about eczema last week, you know, but a short course of steroids are totally appropriate and won't cause that skin atrophy if they're just used in short courses.
Before we wrap up, Dr. Wall, you were telling me a little bit off air about this COVID database that you and your colleagues are compiling. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
My background is as a dermatologist, but I work a day a week with a charity that I helped put together called National International Skin Registries. We build patient registries. And one of the things that we realized around the time of COVID is that some of the theory that's out there suggests that factors that affect hair thinning may also have an outcome on COVID and how people do. So androgens, those male hormones I talked about earlier, seem to potentially play a role in good or bad outcomes of COVID. And as a result, people theorize that some of the anti-androgen treatments that you use in COVID may be protective. Now, it's one thing to theorize that, it's another thing to get the evidence together. And what I've done is, I've, along with Rod Sinclair in Melbourne, the two of us are leading a global patient registry that we've developed called Secure Alopecia. With Secure Alopecia, what we're asking people is that if you have or if you develop hair loss, and if you've been unfortunate enough to get COVID, what we're hoping people can do is if you ask your physician to enter information about the course that you've had through COVID. So that sounds like quite a lot of work, but actually it really only takes about 5 minutes. It's fully anonymized, it's online, it's Secure Derm is the name of the website.
SecureDerm.com.
And
okay. Dr. Dimitri Wall, thank you so much for your time today, because I think it was a conversation well worth having, because like you said, our hair, and particularly in women, but in men as well, it's so important to us. And, you know, I think when it starts to change or when we lose it, it can be really psychologically distressing. So it's really nice to hear from a specialist who knows so much about it, and for us to hear that there are options available for people and that you don't have to suffer with it in silence, and you don't have to spend a lot of money and try to figure out what supplements to buy or what diet you should be adhering to, that you can seek help, and there are treatments available.
Men and women who have concerns about their hair loss, and it's far more than people realize, they're often very vulnerable because you're looking for any solution. And there's a lot of groups out there who are very happy to provide you with treatments that are not necessarily shown to work. Whether or not you even consider whether there's harm there or not. So Ireland is funny. We're not really allowed to talk about hair loss, but we're made to feel very bad about it. And it's something that I would like people to be able to have a little bit more information about, not feel so alone about it, and also feel that there are people out there who are doing their best in terms of research to get better answers and to try and put people in the position where you get better treatments that are safer and more effective year on year.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation with Dr. Wall. Hair thinning and hair loss is such a big subject, and we couldn't get to everything we need to get to today. But thankfully, I will be following up with the medical director of Hair Restoration BlackRock, Dr. Morris Collins. He's going to speak to us more about hair loss and hair thinning, as well as hair restoration. I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I hope you can join us. Bye for now.